Well, good morning. Am I on? Can you hear me? Am I good? Okay, great. It just sounds a little bit distant up here. There we go. Let's take a moment and as you pray for Alpha Ministries and for what's going on. I don't know the timing, obviously, with the time differences happening overseas. Things may be happening as we speak, and let's just ask the Lord to bless what's going on over there for His glory and for the preservation and the propagation of the gospel. So let's pray. Father, we're just very, very grateful that your church spreads not despite persecution, but oftentimes because of it, and that it's not the case, it's never been the case, it's never been the paradigm throughout the history of your church that it has expanded because it's been comfortable. Whenever it's uncomfortable, that's when the gospel spreads. The gospel meets Caesar in the arena, and the gospel wins. The gospel meets skeptics around the world, and the gospel wins. The gospel meets persecution in India, in the Middle East, in parts of Southeast Asia, in Africa, and all around the world, and the gospel still wins, not by power nor by might, but by your Spirit. And so we do ask, Lord, that your Spirit rest upon the situation. Holy Spirit, would you move in the hearts of the believers who are there, but also in a supernatural way, touch the minds and the hearts of those who might oppose or who might want to meet, and the branches, the bank people might feel like there's an imposition of a legal requirement here and there, but there are loopholes, Lord, that you can make evident to people. Soften the hearts of those who might try to oppose the work that's happening through Alpha Ministries. We thank you for Alpha. We thank you for Benny. We thank you for all the work that's happening. We thank you for the distribution of your word. For every Bible that's burned, I know 10,000 more are being printed, Lord, and we just are grateful for technology that can do this and for those Christians who are like-minded who want to support this ministry with their time, talent, and treasure, Lord. So we're just grateful that we get to pray these things, and we ask, Lord, for your protection on the ministry and its continued propagation of the gospel for a country that you made and that you have loved and that you love dearly. And want them nothing more than for them to know who your son is so they can know who you are and bask in your presence in that eternal glory. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, friends, I'm going to traverse from India now and come back to the West, so to speak. But it's funny because as I travel all over the world, I begin to see some phenomena that are happening all over the place, all over the world. I don't care if I go to Hong Kong. I don't care if I'm going to Thailand. I don't care if I'm in India or wherever it might be. There's snippets of a cultural movement that's been happening all around the world, and especially here, it's really taken root here in the West, but I begin to see it seep in to other parts of the world, largely because of technology. And what it is this ongoing culture of confusion. And what I want to speak to you about this morning is basically the Cliff Notes version of the book that's available at the bookstore, but it's my latest book, Saving Truth, Finding Meaning and Clarity in a Post-Truth World. And I want to talk about what it means to be involved in a post-truth world, how you can actually bring credibility and truth to a culture that seems to have abandoned it altogether. How can you do that? It's a very daunting task, but I think it's possible. But before I continue, I want to thank Kent Bowden and his family and Miha and them for sponsoring my wife and I and my kids to be here. You might not be able to come, I think, tomorrow and the next day to the services, but they had us in honor of Kent's son, who passed away very unexpectedly recently. And you might have seen the banner up here, but sometimes those things fly by too quickly. And I want to express to you my profound and very sincere gratitude that I get to stand here at all and be here. Thank you very much. It's an honor to be here in your son's name. As I speak about this topic of the clarity that we need in a post-truth world of confusion, I'm reminded of something that happened to me a while back. I always think about this when I speak on this topic. I travel a lot internationally. And when I travel internationally, usually I fly. But if you're from Michigan, and my guess is that most of you are, you know that if you live in the Detroit area, the country immediately to your south is Canada, which is bizarre. But the peninsula that comes down that actually has Leamington and Windsor and all these other cities is actually south of Detroit. Which is bizarre. So when I travel into Canada to do speaking, especially in Ontario, I often drive. Now you can go over the Ambassador Bridge or down the Detroit Windsor Tunnel, but oftentimes I'll go over to the Blue Water Bridge, which is north near a town called Sarnia. Well, I was going to an international speaking trip, but it happened to be in a town called Wallaceburg in Ontario. Now, Wallaceburg is located such that you don't actually go to the Blue Water Bridge or the Ambassador Bridge or the tunnel. You actually go by car ferry over and across the river to a town that allows you to get to Wallaceburg a little faster. I was doing a big open-air preaching thing, a big apologetics. It wasn't an apologetics conference. It was an open-air evangelistic preaching event. Now, I pull up to the car ferry, and you're all familiar with, well, the Great Lakes, the ocean-sized lakes that are apparently getting bigger by the second. When you think of car ferry, and you think of maybe the ferries that take you from the western shores of Michigan to the eastern shores of Wisconsin, you don't think, you know, this little tiny boat. You think a ship that can hold 40, 50, 30 cars, whatever it might be. Well, when I got to this little ferry in Algonac, Michigan, that was not what I saw. What I saw was this little tiny rickety white boat where the paint was peeling off of it that could fit two cars maximum. I seriously half expected this guy to pull me across the river Lord of the Rings style, like with a rope or something, you know. Buckleberry Ferry that I'm such a nerd, seriously, by the way, you can already tell. So I got on this little boat, and the guy said, stay in your car, it's not going to be a far journey, just stay in your car. And I was very happy to oblige, because unlike this particular summer, that particular summer was very hot. And it was very hot in that morning, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to stay in my car, air conditioned, and all this. So I stayed in the car. Now, I'm terrible with directions. I seriously can get lost in my own house. I don't know where anything is, and I can't ever find my directions, and my ability to find my way is actually atrophied with the invention of GPSs. I'm actually worse at it now than I used to be, so I'm constantly and incessantly checking my GPS to make sure I'm going to the right place, especially when I'm going overseas or across the border. So I go across the border, so I'm going to go across the border, so I'm looking at my GPS very incessantly, making sure that the signal stays on when I cross or I leave the dock. So I'm looking at the thing incessantly. At the very moment I look at the GPS, that's when the boat leaves the dock. Now, because I was looking down, I didn't see us leave. But because I was in the car, the mass of the car and the suspension absorbed the energy of us leaving. So normally you feel that sort of like that slight jerk. I didn't feel that. So I looked up from my GPS, and I had that weird vertigo kind of feeling. You know the kind of feeling you have when you're sitting in an intersection and there's a bus next to you, and the bus goes forward, and you're not quite sure if it's going forward or you're moving backward? And you had that slight panic because you think you might kill someone, right? So the first thing you do is hit your brake even harder. And then you look for some fixed point of reference. You look for a mailbox or a streetlight or a building, something that depicts whether or not you're moving. Because the bus is not going to help you, because if it's moving relative to you, it's not going to be a very help. But you need something that is a fixed point of reference. Well, I was in a river. There are no fixed points of reference. Everything is moving. If the boat's moving, that's not going to help me because I was on the boat. And the river itself is in a constant state of flux, so that's not going to help me. It's when I began to see that the distant shore was actually getting larger and larger in my field of vision. That's when the sort of momentary nausea and panic or whatever it might be, the vertigo, got cleared up. When I began to see the fixed point of reference and my movement relative to it. The problem with culture today is that we're in the river. We are now in a situation where fixed points of reference are starting to disappear, or we don't actually like fixed points of reference. In fact, I would venture to say this, culturally and even intellectually speaking, we left the sure foundations so long ago, we left the dry land so long ago that now we have our sea legs, and when we get on something stable, that makes us queasy. We like the instability, but we're seeing the negative effects of that instability as well. I want you to think about the questions. In the first session we had this week, I mentioned some of those questions, obviously, like what does it mean to be male? What does it mean to be female? What does it mean to be a married couple? Does marriage actually mean something, or can it be malleable based on what the society happens to think at that particular time? The racial issues we're seeing in our world today, things where we actually are starting to debate whether or not systemic racism actually exists, when we know, in fact, that there's very, very serious issues going on around our world, but there's issues about what it means to be human. We're not asking just male and female questions. We're not asking race and ethnicity questions. We're now asking fundamental questions about species. What does it mean to be human? There is a movement afoot There's two different movements. One's called transhumanism, which is the idea that human beings can be augmented to be better than we actually are designed to be. Now, this started off as an original therapy where we wanted to actually treat certain diseases, whether it was certain issues with eyes and blindnesses or vision problems or ear problems or various genetic disorders that could be treated in the womb through gene therapy, where you could inject good DNA or good genes into some troubled areas, and then that would actually repair itself in the womb so the kid would be born without the challenges they would ordinarily face. But now people are taking that kind of therapy and saying, you know what, I don't want to repair something that's already gone wrong. I want to actually fix that which we have. Wouldn't it be great if we could see infrared light? Wouldn't it be great if our hearing was almost super? Wouldn't it be great if we could actually select for the way kids look and how tall they might be? And then we're actually adding appendages to our bodies. This is happening right now. They're called biohackers, people who actually take their own bodies, invent little machines, and then insert those machines into their body to see if it works, if they can have a greater grip strength or can pick up heavier objects. This is actually not science fiction. There's a book coming out called Humans 2.0 by scientists and philosophers who are pointing out the dangers of this kind of thing. This is a phenomenon that is happening now. We are now questioning things that were once solidified. We're now saying we can move that. The other movement is to do the opposite. Instead of heightening humans, we're beginning to lessen humans. We're beginning to make them something less than what they actually are. We're actually, it's called reductionism, the idea that humans are no more than sophisticated chimps or that we are just chemical computers. And you have people like Sam Harris and Daniel Dennett and all these sort of philosophers and bioethicists and neuroscientists who are basically saying all we are is machines with chemical components, and we don't actually respond to evidence. We don't actually have rational thinking. We don't have moral thinking. We just simply have response to external stimuli. And so instead of maybe incarcerating people or finding them guilty of a crime, no one's actually guilty of any kind of crimes because there was no crime to begin with, and there's no such thing as guilt anyway because computers can't have guilt. And if you're a computer, we don't actually try to morally persuade or punish. What we should do is chemically enhance. So we're having these questions now about what it means to be human. All of these issues are seeping down into the younger generations, and I'm glad to see that there are a number of young people in this room today, because we, those of us who are in our 40s, children of the 80s, basically gave this to you, but those of us who are older might not have to live with the consequences of these things, but you will. You are asking these questions, and you're going to have to answer them. In our day, you are living with that aftermath. Is it any wonder, then, that this is the generation that has the highest levels of anxiety between the ages of 8 and 18. I mean, look, we look around here, we see that most of the people here are either children of the 80s or had children who were children of the 80s. And you're just figuring out who you are now. You're just figuring it out. I'm 46 years old and I finally became comfortable thinking that, what was I so worried about in my 20s? And you are, you're freaked out about everything in your 20s. In your 30s, you're actually thinking professionally, my goodness, if I mess up, I'm going to ruin my life and all these things. And you realize in your 40s, you were uptight for no good reason. But you sort of figure out who you are. Can you imagine telling an 8-year-old, you can figure out who and even what you are, and by the way, we're going to solidify that decision chemically and surgically for you. Now, if it's hard for you, after decades of trying to figure yourself out, to finally know who you are, what business does a 10-year-old have figuring that out? And by the way, the worst crime is this, not that they're trying to figure themselves out because everyone thinks they know themselves, it's that adults who should know better are enforcing that decision on them. Is it any wonder they have high anxiety and suicide is the leading cause of death outside of car accidents of teenagers? You see, we're living in this culture of confusion where nothing is set anymore and everything's moving. Now, what's interesting about this is that we've actually embraced confusion as a virtue, and we've decried clarity as a sin. I want you to think about what's going on now, and we're thinking about all these questions, and we want what we want to be the champion. We want someone to champion our desires. So we want someone to be our champion and say, I want this, and therefore I'm entitled to this, and therefore this person should champion me. And we have people who are competing to be our gladiators, to be the one who will lead us into this sort of mythic utopia where everyone's desires will be fulfilled, which is ridiculous, just inherently in and of itself. But as a child of the 80s, I remember there was a phenomenon, they called it Cold War neurosis or nuclear war neurosis, where children were waking up in the middle of the night screaming because they had these nightmares that the USSR, the former Soviet Union, and the United States in this massive Cold War power struggle made that Cold War nuclear hot because someone finally pushed a button. And kids were waking up in the middle of the night screaming about this. It's very similar today. Mark Twain once said that history does not repeat, but it sure does rhyme. And he's right about this. Today we're seeing that same level of anxiety. And in the 80s, when that was going on, there was a song called Land of Confusion. And the band Genesis wrote the song. And it's been made recently. But think about the words of the song. There was this one stanza of the song, "Oh Superman, where are you now? When everything's gone wrong somehow, these men of steel, these men of power are losing control by the hour. Superman, where are you now? When everything's gone wrong somehow, these men of steel, these men of power are losing control by the hour." All the people who say, "I'm a man of steel," or "I'm a woman of steel, and I will be the one to champion whatever it is you desire," and all these things, and they say that we'll grab the power, but they seem to be careening out of control. Was that happening in the 80s? To some degree it was, but could that song written 30 years ago apply to today? That song could be written yesterday. Because they're here, they're there. The women of steel and the men of steel are claiming to be the ones who can get you there. But they seem to be losing control by the hour. Is it any wonder then that superhero movies are so popular? See, we've embraced this culture of confusion where we think confusion is a virtue and clarity is a sin. And why is that? Well, here's the reason. Confusion blurs the lines. If confusion becomes a virtue, then we don't have any boundaries to live within anymore. We can sort of, there's fuzzy lines everywhere and things blur into each other, and so we're not morally responsible in any way if we make choices, bad or good or whatever it might be, because there's no bright lines, there's no boxes, there's no lines anymore. Now, I'm not in favor of boxes for boxes' sake or arbitrary borders for borders' sake, but we need to have some level of those borders in order to enjoy what it means to be human in the first place. But we don't want that. We have all this fuzziness. We're embracing confusion as a virtue and clarity as a sin. Let me give you an example. If you take anyone who's confused sexually or even in what it means to be a man or a woman, I want you to think about this. Everybody who's come out as being sexually confused in some way is a hero. They're lionized as a hero. They're brave, right? If you're confused morally, like you're like, "I don't want to impose my morality," which whatever that means, my morality, on someone else, and so let live and let live. Well, that's considered progressive. And if you're confused religiously, you know, all paths lead to God, and I described this in my first talk about how that's ridiculous, but all paths lead to God, then you're considered tolerant. So confusion sexually, you're a hero. Confusion morally, you're progressive. Confusion religiously, you're tolerant. But if you're clear on sexual restriction, and you're clear on maybe there is a binary that we should stick to, well, that's considered bigoted. If you're clear on moral strictures, that there is an objective moral standard that we have to comply with, well, that's considered regressive. And if you're clear that there is one path to God, and I'm not singing hallelujah because it happens to be my path, it's not a possessive thing, I'm just glad that there's even one path and that God himself provided evidence for that one path, well, that's considered intolerant. So confusion becomes a virtue, clarity becomes a sin. But we are clear on one thing, though. Here's what we're clear on, and I don't care what side of the spectrum, politically or socially, you stand on. If you don't agree with me, you're Hitler. Have you noticed this? Now, careful what I said. I didn't say, if you disagree with me, you're Hitler. I said, if you don't agree with me, you can't even be neutral. You can't have a measured opinion. You can't say, "I'll wait to see what the facts actually say." In fact, there's been people who have said that. "Let's wait and see how the science plays out. Let's wait and see how the facts play out." I'm like, no, take a stand now. And if you don't, you're Hitler or Stalin or Pol Pot or whatever it is. Pick your sort of dictatorial person everyone hates, and that becomes you. So that's what we have now. We have this clarity on one thing. They, whoever they happen to be, are always horrible. If you're on the right, the left is always telling lies. If you're on the left, the right is always telling lies. If you're a centrist, the right and the left are always telling lies. We fail to see the common good in anybody anymore. We fail to see that maybe someone we disagree with might be wrong-headed, but possibly right-hearted. Possibly. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're wrong-headed and wrong-hearted. But sometimes they're not, actually. We fail to see that we need to go in the common good. It was Oz Guinness, who I was at a religious freedom forum in Canada at the behest of some ministers of parliament there. And Oz Guinness said, you know, we have to stop talking about just this if we're really only referring to just us. Everyone deserves it. Everyone gets it, even those who don't agree with us. Everyone gets their equal say, as it were. But see, the reason for this, and if you don't mind my just taking a little bit of time to set the groundwork, because it's important you understand how we got to where we got so you can offer a solution, because criticism without a solution is just basically complaining. And that's not the Christian life. But we need to understand how we got here. How did we get to this point? I think it's because we stopped talking about freedom a long time ago. We keep using the word, but like Amigo Montoya would say, I don't think we know what it means. We keep using that word, but it's the wrong word. You see, freedom is like the chief virtue of the West. When you think of Western virtue and Western democracy and all things, you think of freedom, that democracy and Republican democracies are supposed to actually propagate freedom. But freedom is not what we're talking about anymore. Now we're talking about autonomy. And those are two different things. We think they mean they're synonymous, autonomy and freedom. If I'm autonomous, I have freedom from restraints. And that's one kind of freedom. But there's also freedom for the greater good. You use your freedom from restraint in order to conform it to a moral purpose for the greater good, and that requires self-restraint, as Isaiah Berlin would say. But we forgot that. So now we're not talking about freedom anymore. Freedom has two sides. Freedom from restriction, but freedom for the greater good. Now we just want freedom from restriction. And that's like talking about a one-sided coin, which is ridiculous. Autonomy and freedom are not synonymous. Autonomy comes from two Greek root words, autos, meaning self, and nomos, meaning law. So when you are autonomous, you are a law unto yourself. Now that means you can say, think, act, be, do whatever you want, whenever you want, in whatever way you want. And that is not freedom. It sounds like it, but it's not, because it's a very serious issue. I'll explain that by saying this. The reason what we're in now in this culture of confusion is what's called the post-truth culture. In 2016, Oxford English Dictionaries named its word of the year, and that word of the year was post-truth. Every year, Oxford names a word. And it, you know, I think 2 years ago or last year, the word was toxic. It's a word that captures the ethos and the passions and the fascinations of the culture at that particular moment in time. And in 2016, especially at the end of the election cycle, the word was post-truth. Now, what it means to be post-truth is this. You are post-truth if you elevate feelings and preferences above facts and truth. If you elevate feelings and preferences above facts and truth. Now, take notice, okay, this is a slight difference from postmodernism. Postmodernism was this idea that there is no such thing as objective truth, that all truth was relative to your situation or to your opinions. And this is a movement that started in the 60s, gained some sway, but eventually is now dying its death, thank goodness. But in the ash from the ashes of post-truth is rising up the phoenix of, from the ashes of postmodernism is rising up the phoenix of post-truth. Now, understand the difference here. It's very important you understand the difference. Postmodernism says there's no such thing as objective truth. Now, if I were to look at someone and they said to me, you know, there's no such thing as objective truth, my response is simply this. Is that statement objectively true? Because if the statement is objectively true, then the statement itself is false. And if the statement itself is false, why did you say it? It's self-defeating. You can actually reason with a postmodern person because they do actually allow for the faculty of reason to be the most important discussion point. So postmodernism dies because it's intellectually untenable. But post-truth is different. Postmodernism says there is no objective truth. Post-truth says truth exists, but my preferences matter more. In other words, when someone says, yeah, there's a truth, but my preferences matter more, and you say, yeah, but here are the 15 reasons why that preference is going to lead to destruction, their response is, I don't care. They'll acknowledge the truth you're giving them, but they'll say, I don't care. That's a tough one, because how do you make someone care? How do you make someone care? See, we've sacrificed clarity and truth on the altar of human autonomy. We want to be the rulers of the world. We want to be the ones who can do whatever we want, whenever we want, in whatever way we want. Now, I want to caution you on something. Before we start saying kids today, you know, or Gen X or Gen Z or millennials, before we start generation bashing, I wanted to point out something to you that's very, very biblical about human anthropology, about the study of human beings. The first post-truth people were Adam and Eve. And everyone since. Every single, me. I can tell you this right now. If preferences are elevated over feelings, if preferences and feelings mean more than facts and truth in a post-truth world, when I was a Muslim, I very much wanted Islam to be true. And when I began to see the mounting evidence in favor of Christianity, I was willing at some point to intellectually assent that that's true, but I wasn't willing to give my life to it because my preference is that I wanted to be a Muslim, even though the truth was that I shouldn't be anymore. I was as post-truth as anybody else. Adam and Eve walk and talk with God in the cool of the day, Genesis says, and they're given one command: do not eat of this certain fruit of this certain tree, the knowledge of good and evil, for the day you eat of it, you shall surely die. And who knows how long they lived with that temptation or that law without temptation, never tempted once to imbibe of this fruit. Who knows how long? I don't know. But then along comes Satan, and then he misquotes God to them. And then Eve, as the first one, misquotes God back. And now Satan knows, I've got her. I've got him too, because he's not going to follow. He's not going to take too hard to convince. She said, God said, don't even touch it, don't even look at it, and all these things. And Satan, he didn't say that. Just don't eat of it. And Satan says, did God really say in all these things? And he says, God knows that in the day you eat of it, you will not die, but you will be like God. And that's suddenly when this fruit that never bothered her before, and never bothered Adam before, that's when it suddenly became tempting and desirous. That's when it happened. See, what had happened was the truth that they were told was, you are in this garden to be with me. That's what God told them. Your purpose is relationship with me. They didn't want that truth. The preference that they had was mattered more, was that I don't want to be with you, God. I want to be you. The seeds of the post-truth culture were planted in the very first garden, and now it's got its own fruit in our day, and we're imbibing of it left, right, and center. How do you deal with this? I think there's two ways. Now, before I go on, I want to make sure you understand, I'm actually an optimist, believe it or not. I know that sounds sort of gloomy, but here's the two ways I think we deal with a post-truth culture that's careening out of control. One, and I've seen it work, by the way. One is you point out the negative consequences of a post-truth mindset. This is an increasingly pragmatic culture. Give me what works. I want to know what works. What works? What does work? And they had this false syllogism in their head that if it works, therefore it's true. That's not the case at all. Now, if it's true, it will work. But the reverse isn't true. But you do have to show this increasingly pragmatic culture, I want to do what works or believe what works, that post-truth doesn't work. You're going to show the negative consequences. But when you've created the vacuum now, I think it's important that we offer the hope that truth himself can bring. So point out how post-truth doesn't work, and then offer the hope. Let me do those in sequence, and hopefully we'll get a little time to interact. I'll try to be brief as I can. And by the way, I want to encourage you. It's working, because we've gone to open forums. I went to Michigan State University at the Breslin Center. 9,500 people filled that place up when Ravi and I went there, and our topic was Ask Anything, and they lined up with their questions, and they asked anything. And they weren't gotcha questions. I think that these students have engaged in the post-truth bender, and now they're in the grisly hangover, and they want a pill, and they want the truth. And I'm telling you, that's one example. University of Florida, 7,000. University of Michigan, 3,500. Berkeley, California. I sat there and spoke at Berkeley on this topic, and it went well, actually. They do want it. they are looking for it. Don't write them off. First consequence of a post-truth mindset that sacrifices clarity and truth on the altar of human autonomy is we lose our lack of wisdom. We lose any sense of wisdom, and we lose any sense of reason. So I was in a room roughly about this size, maybe a little bit, not about this size, with this number of people most likely crammed into this room to hear my testimony about how I went from Islam to Christ. And there was a guy in the front row, and he was taking very, very rapid notes, which is probably not uncommon given how fast I speak. But he was going like this, and smoke from the page kind of thing, and I was thinking fire extinguisher is probably a good idea to have near us because of this guy. Now, normally, the person who's taking furious notes sitting at the front row is the first guy to come up and talk to you after you were done, and sure enough, that's what happened. So he walked up to me, and I explained my testimony, how I went from Islam to Christianity, specifically, more specifically, Islam to Christ, and he said this, "I appreciate that you didn't disagree with Islam in your testimony." I'm like, "I don't think you got the point." Now, the reason why he thought that, though, careful listener, but he got that because when I talk about how I became a Christian, it's not because this was false. It was because this was true. I didn't leave Islam because it was false. I became a Christian because that happens to be true, and there's great reasons for it. And by implication, everything that stands against it is therefore false. But I don't spend my time, especially in my evangelism, trying to tell people how dumb they are or how wrong they are. I talk about how beautiful and how credible the gospel is, and the light that shines attracts people. But he thought I didn't disagree with Islam. I'm like, "Hey, buddy, let me just tell you something. If I didn't disagree with it, I would have stayed that way and saved myself and a lot of people a lot of pain." He said, "But go on, continue." So he says to me, "Can I show you something?" And that means, buckle up. It's going to be a long conversation. So he had this diagram he had drawn. And in the diagram, he had this like really thickly scribbled capital T in the middle of it. And around the capital T were all these little lowercase T's in a circle around it, pointing towards it. And he says, "The big T represents the total absolute truth. There is a total absolute truth that's out there." And I said, "Good, I agree with you." He says, "But we don't know all of it. None of us knows all of it." I'm like, "Okay, I agree with you there too. Because if I knew all the truth, then I would know everything. And if I knew everything, I would be God. So far, we agree that I'm not God. We're off to a great start." he says, "But all of us are the little lowercase T. We all," this is what he said, "we all have incomplete but equally valid versions of the truth. And because they're all incomplete, we can't say anybody else's is less valid than ours." Like, so let me get this straight. Are you saying everyone had equally valid versions of the truth? He said, "Yeah." I said, "Hitler? Idi Amin? Pol Pot? Joseph Stalin? I can keep going. These men all had equally valid versions of the truth." And this is what he said to me. He said, "I'm telling you, because my version of the truth is incomplete. I don't prefer their version, but I can't disagree with it." And I'm like, "Buddy, if you want to disagree with somebody, Hitler's a safe bet. No one really gets offended if you disagree with Hitler. And those who do get offended, I'm okay with that." And he said, "But I can't disagree with anybody." So look, I said, "I want to make sure this. I got this straight in my mind. Are you telling me that you can't disagree with anybody?" He said, "That's right." I said, "Sure you can." He said, "No, I can't." I said, "You just did it." I was a trial lawyer for 16 years. That helps. Now, my point wasn't to try to embarrass this guy. It really wasn't, because he's a very well-meaning, very well-read, and very thoughtful guy, by the way. But the point is this, is that he had given up his God-given wisdom for his preferences. He sacrificed it on the altar of his preference. His preference was, no one disagrees, we all get along, we're all equally, our ideas are all equal, we're all equal people, but our ideas are not. But he wants to have that and not do the hard work of seeing who's right and who's wrong. Well-meaning, wrong-headed. And I knew it worked because I walked outside and there he was by the car saying, "If I can't disagree with anybody, but I disagreed with him." He was doing that kind of a thing, and I've seen him since then and all, and so it worked. But it has societal implications as well. I don't know if you remember this video in 2015. There was a video that was circulating on YouTube, and you can probably see it even today. There was a protest that was organized by the football team at the University of Missouri over some racial injustices that were happening on campus. Now, because it's a public university involving a major Division I football team, and it's about a very hot button, very important issue, naturally you want the press to show up. Because if it's not the press showing up, then it's just a bunch of guys sitting on the lawn complaining. So you want the press to show up. But they have these quote-unquote safe zones where, for some reason, in a public place outside in the open, the press can't come at a public university, which is just, frankly, just silly. Well, ESPN sends a photojournalist there to take pictures. Not interview anybody, just take pictures. He's trying to get pictures of the football players there. And a woman jumps in front of the camera and starts trying to block his view and all this stuff. And eventually she says, I need some muscle over here to help remove this aggressor. Who's going to help me get this guy out of here? Physically remove a journalist from a public university on a public protest. Do you know what she teaches for a living at the university? Journalism as part of the communications department. You can't get more confused than that. She's willing to violate the freedom of the press, the First Amendment right of a journalist. That very freedom that makes her job even possible. It matters. We lose all sense of wisdom and even reason when we sacrifice truth on the altar of our preferences. The second casualty, though, and I want to race through this. There's a number of them. I go into the book about some of them. But the second casualty I will talk about today, as others talk about, but the one I'll talk about today, is probably the most dire one. It's a lack of accountability and therefore a value for other human beings. Protagoras said centuries ago, man is the measure of all things. Man is the measure of all things. There are no gods above us who can dictate to us what morality should be or what truth should be. So we are the measure of all things. He said that centuries ago, and we've been saying it ever since. I want you to hear the words of Tom Flynn, a secular humanist writer, who's a very thoughtful guy, by the way, but this is what he says. He says the same thing that Protagoras said, man is a measure of all things, but he simply says it in highfalutin, very complicated terms. But listen to what he says. Secular humanism maintains that through a process of value inquiry informed by scientific and reflective thought, men and women can reach rough agreement concerning values, crafting ethical systems that offer optimal results for a wide range of circumstances. That is a mouthful of a way to say we are the measure of all things. But he says this specifically, through a process of value inquiry informed by scientific and reflective thought, we can reach rough agreement concerning values. My question is this, where is this mythical rough agreement concerning values? If you go to the Middle East, if you go to India and you see the persecution happening there, if you go to the Middle East and you see the conflict happening there, if you go to our universities and you see the protests that are happening there, where things are being lit on fire in the very places where the free speech movement was birthed, and you're telling me there's a rough agreement concerning values? Do you recall the incident at Middlebury College where it was Charles Murray, no relation by the way, but Charles Murray, who was giving a speech, relatively lightning rod guy, and he couldn't give a speech in front of the audience. He had to do it into an empty room with a camera there because the protests were so threatening that he couldn't even be in the room of the people who he wanted to have hear his message. And then he and Alison Stenger, who doesn't agree with anything he has to say, I believe, were both attacked, and she got attacked by virtue of being next to the man, physically. So the question becomes this, have we reached this rough agreement concerning values, or we have simply arrived at a place where we've agreed to be rough? That's the rough agreement, is that we want to be rough now. We have to shut people up and all these things. Why? Because there's no accountability anymore. If there is no absolute or objective moral law above us, then we are the ones who dictate things and can determine what's true and what's good or what's not good, and we can shun people and all these things. You see, here's my point. When truth is put on the lower shelf, and preferences and feelings matter more, and autonomy is the way we go, where I'm a law unto myself. So understand this. If I'm a law unto myself, and you're a law unto yourself, and my preferences matter more than truth, and your preferences matter more than truth, and my preferences happen to clash with your preferences, and we meet in the global public square, or in the public square that used to be civil, but now it's not. If we meet there and my preferences clash with yours and truth is no longer the arbiter, it's no longer the tool that decides who's right and who's wrong, what will be the decider of who's right and who's wrong? It will be power. And what's interesting about that is in our quest for autonomy, for unlimited freedom, someone gets enslaved. Because not all preferences matter, just the one with the microphones or the guns. And that's what's happening. That's why we have this agreement to be rough. Reminds me of that poem by Alexander Pope in that stanza in Essays on Man where he says, go wiser thou, and in thy scale of sense weigh thy opinion against providence. Call imperfection what thou fancy as such. Say here he gives too little and there too much. Destroy all creatures for thy sport or gust. Yet cry if man's unhappy, then God's unjust. If man alone engross not heaven's highest care, alone made perfect here, immortal there, snatch from his hand the balance and the rod, rejudge his justice and become the God of God. In pride, in reasoning pride our error lies, all quit their spheres and rush to the skies. Pride is still aiming at the blessed abodes. Men will be angels, angels will be gods, aspiring to be gods if angels fell, aspiring to be angels, men rebel. And who but seeks to invert the laws of nature sins against the eternal cause. What he's saying, and he said this decades ago, is that when we take on this mantle of autonomy and we sacrifice truth for our own desires, we are going to end up in a world where the laws of nature are inverted altogether. That's prophetic. I'm not sure God gave him that, but I do know that he predicted things happening. And in fact, it is secular atheist Jews like Yuval Harari in his book Sapiens who point this out as well. If you don't know who Yuval Harari is, I can guarantee you the people who are their 20s and 30s, they actually know who he is. They've read his stuff in his book Sapiens. Listen to what a secular atheist Jew has to say about what's going on in our culture today when we've gotten no more accountability because we are the gods of the universe. He says, 70,000 years ago, Homo sapiens was still an insignificant animal minding its own business in a corner of Africa. In the following millennia, it transformed itself into the master of the entire planet and terror of the ecosystem. Today, it stands on the verge of becoming a god, poised to acquire not only eternal youth, but also the divine abilities of creation and destruction. We are more powerful than ever before, but have very little idea of what to do with all that power. Worse still, humans seem to be more irresponsible than ever before. Self-made gods with only the laws of physics to keep us company, we are accountable to no one. We are consequently wreaking havoc on our fellow animals and on the surrounding ecosystem, seeking a little more than our own comfort and amusement, yet never finding satisfaction. Listen to what he says. Is there anything more dangerous than dissatisfied and irresponsible gods who don't know what they want? So through scientific inquiry and reflective thought, we'll come to rough agreement concerning values, and somehow this will make us free. Our genius will make us free. This ridiculous machine, we call these phones for reasons I still don't understand. No one makes calls on these anymore. There's more computing power in this machine, in this one machine, than in the computers that sent the first rocket to the moon. In your pocket. And you can see anything you want. You can read anything you want. You can disseminate whatever you want around the world. And we think these things have made us autonomous and free, access to everything we want. And we can buy stuff immediately with the click of a button. So let me ask you, how free do you feel by this machine? By our ingenuity? You know, you ever have your phone die and there's no charger around? You get twitchy? You do. You ever have this thing happen to you? Where your phone's on the table, and it vibrates in your pocket, and it's not really vibrating. You just feel like it is. It's like a referred pain. You know who has that same sensation? People who have lost limbs. They still feel pain in the limb that's no longer there. We're so dependent on these little machines. They're like a limb to us now, and when it's not around, we can feel it. This is not a freedom device. It can be used that way, but it's not. We call these things Siri and Alexa and whatever. We say, hey, Google, and whatever does stuff. And what do we do with these things? Cyberbully. Look at pornography. We look at people as objects for our baser desires. So we humanize these objects that we use to objectify humans. And we think, absent a savior, that we're going to be free. And that we can actually take our lack of accountability and be fine. No, we devalue human beings. But there is a hope. I've seen when the consequences begin to open the eyes of people enmeshed in this worldview, they begin to see this is the problem, but where's the hope? And they don't want to look to the Bible as that hope, even though that's the place. And the reason they don't want to look to the Bible is because they think that the Bible is an instrument of restriction. It's arbitrary restrictions on sexuality and morality and all these things. It's an arbitrary book that tells you what not to do, and somehow it's against freedom. Now, to be sure, the Bible is against autonomy. It stands against autonomy because that results in chaos. But it's not against freedom. It is a freedom-allowing book. And let me show you why. Because autonomy is the ability to do whatever you want, whenever you want, in whatever way you want. And that is bedlam and chaos. Freedom necessarily has to have restrictions. Not too many, but just enough. I'll give you an example of what I mean. So when my wife and I, maybe some of you have met my three kids that are here, but back when we only had one, when Yusuf, my oldest now, who's 15, was not even 1 year old, we were looking at houses and we came across a house that we really liked. Had a really nice big backyard, and we're like, man, we could really enjoy this backyard. Problem with it is that there's cars and trucks whizzing by it all the time because it backs up to a main road. So we're like, well, I don't know if we can get this house because, you know, kids being kids, they'll just run out into the road. The ball runs out in the road, and a truck will come by and pulverize them. So what we needed to do was establish a boundary. Beyond this, you cannot play. Because if there was no boundary, then they would be unable to enjoy the purpose of the backyard, which is for them to be able to play there and us to be able to enjoy it. But with a boundary, then they could enjoy the purpose. In other words, they had no freedom to be in the backyard unless there was just enough boundaries. Freedom always dies when there's no restrictions, but it thrives when there's just enough, because freedom and purpose are linked. It was Chesterton himself who said that even art is limitation. We think art has no limitations, but even art is limitation. The essence of every picture is the frame, after all. You may feel in your own creative way that you can draw a giraffe with a short neck, only to find yourself not able to draw a giraffe at all. You may free things from incidental characteristics, he says, but not from fundamental characteristics. You can free a tiger from his bars, but you may not free a tiger from his stripes. If you think that you can draw a camel or create a camel without a hump, you've decided that you have not created a camel at all. Whenever you're dealing with facts, you're dealing with restriction, and freedom is laced with and imbued and bathed in truth and in facts. Jesus has something to say about this. It'll be no surprise to you. John 8:31. I'm sorry I'm taking a little bit longer on this one. Maybe we'll get some time to interact in the next couple of sessions. And what I'm thinking about doing Friday is just having it be a Q&A session. I would love to do that with you guys if you have those questions. John chapter 8, verse 31 to 36. It's very familiar to all of you. Many of you have read this numerous times. I want to show you a couple of couplings, I think, that are sometimes missed, because familiarity with a passage can help us to not see some of the obvious things that we once saw. So Jesus said to the Jews who had believed him, "If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Did you catch it? You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Truth and freedom are linked. They're coupled together, inextricably coupled together. That's very different than what the culture says. The culture says that preferences leads to freedom. Jesus says that truth leads to freedom, and you must know it. Now, their response is staggeringly bad. It's actually comical. This is what they say to him. "We are offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it you say you should become free?" You're offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone? Did you forget the 400-year bondage you had to Egypt? How could you forget it? You celebrate Passover every year. And by the way, you know when they're saying that? While under Roman occupation. You see the power of preferences to actually distort your view of reality? And then Jesus responds to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son sets you free, you'll be free indeed." Did you catch it again? "You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. The son sets you free. The son is the truth." The son is the truth that sets you free. Now, you can't just make that kind of a statement. You got to back that kind of a thing up. If you claim to be the truth, the very embodiment of truth that sets people free, you have to have more than just, "I sound nice when I talk." he was asked, why should we believe you? In John chapter 2, and he said, when you destroy this temple, meaning his body, I will raise it up again in 3 days. That was a falsifiable claim, and he proved it time and again, at least one time, and he gives us all kinds of evidence for it as well. And I've debated many an atheist on this. You can go and see online my debates with atheists and Muslims on the historicity of the resurrection of Jesus. It's not a matter of hope only. It's a matter of history that provides hope. It really actually happened. People ask me, why do you trust Jesus and not Muhammad or Buddha or Krishna or whatever? And here's my answer. My answer is this. Jesus rose from the dead, and the guy who rises from the dead tends to have credibility. I can believe what he says, that he is the truth that sets us free. So a young man asked me a question at Yale University. He came up to the microphone at the open forum, and he says, I understand how truth leads to freedom. How does Jesus lead to freedom, though? How is he that truth that leads to freedom, and does the resurrection have anything to do with it? What a question. I'm so glad you asked. So I began to talk about some of the evidence for the resurrection. I said, but here's the import of it. Here's what it says. A secular worldview says that you're an accident, that you are basically the random collocation of atoms and chemicals and all these things, and you react in a certain way, and that's who you are, and there's nothing moral, inherently moral about you. You were not previsioned. You are just an accident. So there is no morality on that, and in that sense, there's no freedom either. But Jesus says you are made in the image of God. Now, I believe him because he rose from the dead. If a guy says that and then rises from the dead, he tends to have a little more authority than anybody else. So he says you are made in his image. He also says that you have strayed from your original purpose, that we have rejected God and we have sinned against him and incurred a very serious debt that we can never pay. And you already know that through your own experience. How can you possibly repay the infinite God for the infinite offense you've created to him? And you, a finite being, you cannot do it. What you need is someone who has no debts of his own to pay for your debts. I can't pay for your debts. I got my own to pay. He has no debts of his own to pay, and therefore he can say, I will pay yours, and in fact, the whole world's. And then he says, I will pay that by dying on a cross. And then I can know that when he died, he paid my debt because he rose from the dead. Because if he didn't rise from the dead, why would I believe him? Maybe he paid my debts. Maybe he didn't. I don't know. Who cares? I don't know. But he didn't stay dead. He rose from the dead to prove he was right. And you go backwards into this. He rose from the dead to prove that his death on the cross meant something. And what it meant was what he said. And what he said was that he's going to pay your debts. And how do you know you needed that debt to be paid? Because of your own sin in your life. And how do you know that God wants to pay for your debt? Because he said you're made in his image. If the freedom to enjoy that backyard was the freedom to enjoy the purpose for which it was created, and the purpose for which you were created, young man, is to be with God. And you can only enjoy that freedom if Jesus is the one who paid your debt. Freedom is not the ability to do what you want whenever you want. Freedom is the ability to do what you want based on what you should in accordance with what you are. And you are made in God's image, living under the moral law that God allows, and that changes what you want. That's freedom. The secular world knows this. It does. It knows this. There's a song by a band called Crash Parallel. It's called Rain Delays. It's a Canadian band. I quote it at length, in fact, the entirety in my book. In fact, the writers of that, who are not Christians as far as I'm aware, gave me permission to reprint the entire song in the book. And they recognize that the people are trying to fulfill their lives, to find personal fulfillment for their preferences by ascribing to personal truths, and they put their faith in things that are neither true nor personal. This is what the words of this song go like. They say this. Sleepless nights and endless days, waking up from rain delays, selling sex for pocket change, and living off the alcohol with no one but a cab to call, lost inside a bathroom stall, this carbon copy life withdrawal. Driving cars we can't afford, making sure we're never bored, between coffee grinds and corner stores, limousines and cigarettes and chasing dreams with fishing nets and long weekends without regrets. Well, no one here is taking bets. Listen carefully. Because I need someone to believe in, someone to fill the space with grace, someone to look into my eyes and touch my face, someone to make me strong, someone to make me belong, someone to make me feel alive. Anybody else is in need of that same fulfillment, and therefore they can't be your fulfillment. Jerry Maguire was wrong. You don't complete anybody. But the one who is completed himself can complete you. And they said, I need someone to make me alive. Jesus offers us life, not morality. He offers us life. You were dead and you can be made alive through his resurrection. This is what the world needs. Let me just finish with this. 2,000 years ago, Jesus claimed to be the truth that sets us free. And we've been trying to find our freedom in finding things that are neither true nor personal. But it's Christ and Christ alone who can give us freedom, because in him, the truth is a person. God bless you.